India to pay off the arrears. He said the United Nations Secretariat is completely aware of the details of the issue, which he said was not Iran's fault whatsoever. According to a statement by the UN General Assembly, as of 21st of May 2021, 5 member states are subject to provisions of Article 19 of the Charter, including Iran and the Central African Republic.
Nothing is being left unturned. No stone is being left unturned to make Iran bow. Islamic Republic of Iran is arguably one of the last nations still not to be part of the Bank of International Settlements, subjugated sovereign powers. There's a running theme. Those who control those institutions and have those levers of power don't want Iran to succeed in any way, because the Islamic Republic of Iran stands for a set of principles, primarily Islamic principles, but humanitarian principles and real principles of justice and fairness.
This is while the same article allows an exception for member states that can demonstrate that conditions beyond their control contributed to their inability to make payments. But the world body has so far rejected Iran's argument that the impact of the sanctions prevented Tehran from paying off its arrears.
An open letter by dozens of European officials, the purpose to end unwarranted public criticism of inquiries into alleged Israeli war crimes in Palestine. Such is the context of an apparent push by 50 European officials to have the ICC complete its investigation. These officials include former foreign ministers, prime ministers, and senior international officials, including 2 British Conservative former ministers. Roadblocks were thrown the ICC's way when the inquiry opened. The administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump sanctioned ICC court officials from pursuing the matter, something the new U.S. administration reversed.
Well, Donald Trump's position was highly criticized by various governments and many other people, because it was, you know, just totally out of line. There's no question in my mind that Israel's committed human rights violations, and to exempt Israel from any sort of scrutiny is a travesty of justice.
The ICC has less to worry about, at least for now. The letter reads that the purpose of the court is well established and recognized, that accountability for serious rights violations by all sides through conflict is essential for achieving sustainable and lasting peace. The key question is, will the ICC's findings be grounds for holding anyone accountable for prosecution if guilty of war crimes and human rights violations?
Israel's afraid that there will be international warrants issued for various Israeli officials who participated in the planning and directing the attack on Gaza. Gaza is the most densely populated place on the planet. And, you know, if you look at the pictures, you know, whole families were targeted and killed. And it's grossly disproportionate in terms of what the Palestinians were doing. And Israel's attack on Palestinians in Jerusalem was the initial cause of that, which is also very troubling.
The former Danish foreign minister and former president of the UN General Assembly have said a rules-based global order is predicated upon the idea that violations of international law must be met with consequences. The United States and, more importantly, Israel in this case are not members of the ICC, so they do not fall under the ICC's jurisdiction. But the ICC, as an international criminal court, can pursue the rule of law, in this case violations of human rights in occupied Palestine. The investigation in many cases should be an open and shut case, since there are obvious Israeli violations that have taken place over the decades. So many violations that in a recent report, Human Rights Watch called Israel an apartheid regime. This was quite significant, since for the first time ever, Human Rights Watch made the informed and evidence-based assessment that the actions of the Israeli regime with regards to its treatment of the Palestinian people has crossed the threshold qualifying it as apartheid.
I certainly concur with Human Rights Watch's assessment. Several Israeli human rights organizations, B'Tselem, have said the same thing. And if you look at the evidence, there is, it's clear that much of the Israeli policy is punitive. In fact, current Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is quoted, saying that how he was going to punish the Palestinians, and how they would, squeeze them and actually instigate problems for them, so they could reach out and attack the Palestinian population.
Israel finds itself in a precarious state. With no functioning system of governance and isolation on the international stage, it is a very fragile entity. To add to Israel's worry, it's been revealed that the leaders of the resistance groups Hamas and Hezbollah met last year to discuss plans for the liberation of Palestine from the Israeli occupation. The recent blow dealt to Israel during the 11-day Gaza War was also part of the liberation plan. The Palestinian resistance adopted tactics used by Hezbollah during the 2006 war by setting up mock rocket launch sites to deceive the Israeli Air Force. This only means that the Israeli regime's days of violating the Palestinian rights are numbered. Forced evictions, detainment without charge, freedom of movement, home demolitions, and the killing of Palestinians are illegal actions that happen almost on a daily basis. Plus, the three Gaza wars were proof of Israel's disproportionate killing of Palestinians. The question now remains whether a judicial body can prosecute Israel and its officials into obvious cases of war crimes, regardless of the U.S. obstruction of justice in favor of Israel.
When you have former prime ministers, ministers in governments, and high-ranking officials calling for the International Criminal Court to exercise its rights and to investigate war crimes, this is an opportunity to review Israel's actions and, of course, hold them accountable. And there could be warrants issued by the International Criminal Court.
The EU is Israel's biggest trading partner. Of these high-ranking EU officials who really want justice to prevail, they can economically sanction Israel, as called by the BDS movement, boycott, divestment, and sanctions, if Israel does not cooperate with the investigation. Israel faces ever-growing isolation in the international arena and risks continuing with its violations.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
Israeli regime's detention of a reporter and two prominent Palestinian rights activists in Sheikh Jarrah is drawing international condemnation as residents of the East Al-Quds neighborhood continue to resist a forced expulsion campaign led by the regime-backed Israeli settlers. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jake Johnson, writer. This article is published under the heading Israeli regime condemned for arrest of journalists and two activists in Sheikh Jarrah. Stay tuned for more. Israeli regime's detention of a reporter and two prominent Palestinian rights activists in Sheikh Jarrah is drawing international condemnation as residents of the East Al-Quds neighborhood continue to resist a forced expulsion campaign led by regime-backed Israeli settlers. On Saturday, June 5th, Israeli regime police assaulted and arrested Al Jazeera journalist Givara Buderi as she covered a sit-in marking the 54th anniversary of the Zionist regime's 1967 occupation of East Al-Quds, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip. The police also destroyed Al Jazeera cameraman Nabil Mazawi's equipment. Buderi, who at the time of her arrest was wearing a flak jacket that clearly identified her as a member of the press, was released hours later on the condition that she stay away from Sheikh Jarrah for at least 15 days. Buderi's arrest drew sharp rebukes from global press freedom organizations and Al Jazeera, whose acting director general said in a statement that such attempts to prevent journalists from carrying out their professional duty to inform the world and report events on the ground is a crime against the journalistic profession. The Foreign Press Association said the journalist arrest represents just the latest in a long line of heavy-handed tactics by Israeli regime police. Hours after Buderi's release, Israeli regime police reportedly stormed into the home of 23-year-old activist Munal Kurd and arrested her, alleging that she participated in public disturbances in Sheikh Jarrah. Munal has since been freed. The police on Sunday, June 6, also arrested Munal's twin brother Muhammad Al-Kurd, who has gained global attention for fiercely defending Palestinian rights during recent appearances on major media programs. The Al-Kurd family is one of many facing possible expulsion. Israel is on a rampage in Sheikh Jarrah, detaining journalists and prominent Palestinians like Al-Kurd twins, all because they won't shut up about being ethnically cleansed from their homes, tweeted journalist Alex Kane. Middle East Eye reported on Sunday, June 6, that the siblings, whose family has been living under the threat of imminent displacement from their house in Karam al-Jouni, in occupied East Al-Quds Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, have become icons of the Palestinian struggle against Israeli settler expansion, he added. The latest crackdown in Sheikh Jarrah by Israeli regime police came just days before the Supreme Court is set to rule on whether Palestinians in the neighborhood can be expelled from their homes at the behest of Israeli settlers. A hearing on the matter was postponed last month, just before the Zionist regime kicked off its deadly 11-day bombing campaign in the occupied Gaza Strip. The historic Sheikh Jarrah district is inhabited by the descendants of Palestinian refugees who were expelled from their towns and villages by the Zionist militias during the Palestinian Nakba catastrophe of 1948, Middle East Eye noted, adding at least 13 families have been ordered to leave their homes in Sheikh Jarrah since May, including 58 people facing the threat of expulsion from their homes where they lived for generations. In October 2020, an Israeli court ruled in favor of Israeli settlers who claimed that some 8 Palestinian families in Sheikh Jarrah are living on land that used to belong to Jews. Yusuf Monayer, a Palestinian-American writer and political analyst, said on Sunday, June 6th, that through attacking and arresting journalists and now arresting two of its most outspoken advocates in Munal al-Kurd and Muhammad al-Kurd, the Israeli regime is trying to stop you from hearing about Sheikh Jarrah. Adding, the best response is to listen harder and amplify their voices louder. Inside Israel.
Ashkenazi Israelis include white European settlers both on the left and the right side of politics. This elite group of people have been at a struggle with the other marginalized communities in Israel, including the Mizrahi Eastern and Sephardi Spanish and North African Jews, for decades. Nothing highlights this struggle better than the fight over a small neighborhood in northern Israel named the Nir David Kibbutz. The residents of the neighborhood are upper-class Ashkenazi Israelis. This, while all the other neighborhoods around them are lower class residents. Now, during the hot summer days, residents from the surrounding areas would like to enjoy the local Asi River to cool off. However, the residents of Nir David Kibbutz won't allow them to do so unless they paid. This goes contrary to Israeli law, which says that rivers in Israel are allowed to be used by all Israelis. Even after the locals took Nir David residents to court and won, they still do not have access to the water. In recent years, a group of non-Ashkenazi residents from communities around the Nir David Kibbutz have been waging a struggle to ensure free public access to the Asi River. They filed a lawsuit against the kibbutz in 2015 that resulted in the Nir David Kibbutz vowing to open access to sections of the river, a promise they never kept. The struggle to free the Asi River has intensified. Israelis are tired of the same status quo. The Nir David Kibbutz and the Asi River highlights the current social disparities and the overwhelming control and perceived favoritism by courts and the Israeli system towards Ashkenazi Israelis. Over the past few months, residents of the surrounding towns, together with activists from across Israel, have been showing up at the Nir David Kibbutz gates every day in an attempt to access the river. They are mostly upset over the Nir David Kibbutz's continued refusal to adhere to the Water Act and allow them to bathe or swim or enjoy summer times on the river during the several heat waves Israel had this summer. In response, they have been met with locked and guarded gates, as well as violence from kibbutz members who attack them with belts and sticks. Earlier in September, the protesters successfully entered the kibbutz and were able to reach and enjoy the river. The day nevertheless ended with violence, as kibbutz members trapped one of the protesters inside the kibbutz gates, kicking him while he lay on the ground, an attack which sent him to the hospital with a concussion and a bruised kidney. Other protesters found their tires slashed.
Actually, the residents of Nir David doesn't allow anybody to enter the kibbutz, even if you offer payment. The only way that you can enter the kibbutz is if you are a member of the kibbutz, or if you have a friend from the kibbutz that let you in, or you are within an organized group that take part of the touristic enterprise, or you are willing to pay $350 for a zimmer or a suite inside the kibbutz. Only that way you can enter. So the main, if you ask me, the main reason for them to refuse entrance of outsiders is they want to preserve the privilege of swimming and enjoying the Asi River for themselves without the entrance of other people to that area. Well, I think that it will be more accurate to describe this struggle as not as a struggle between the next town to the kibbutz. It's a national struggle, a struggle of personal people or small communities that are taking control over nature resources, claiming themselves to their own, and gaining from the usage of those natural resources against the law. I guess the struggle between the different parties is being symbolized by some people in the public as an ethnical struggle between white Ashkenazis Jews to the Eastern, Middle Eastern, North African Jews. I think there are deeper reasons for that. I think that the struggle is between those with privileges in Israel and not necessarily involve their skin color to those that have no resources and have not been privileged from before.
On social media, the conversation took a different turn. Free Palestine says the parks are planted on the ruins of Palestinian villages. Boycott these parks, boycott terrorist Israel. Mondo Weiss says Al-Sakhina's lands are now part of the nearby Nir David settlement. No physical evidence remains by which the site may be identified, as the entire area has been plowed and turned into agricultural fields. According to Haaretz says, at issue, at least on the face of it, is whether a kibbutz near David has the right to prevent those Israelis who do not live on its grounds from swimming in what is arguably Israel's most beautiful waterway. Joshua says, after years of fighting, kibbutz near David will allow the public to visit the river that runs through it, considered the nicest river in Israel, though they can kiss that goodbye once the masses descend on its aquamarine shores.
Well, they feel superior because the rest of the Israelis came from countries that they were more poor and they were not so well educated. The Jews in Europe, they went to schools and universities, and the other the Arab Jews, Sephardic and Mizrahi, they were more people that they didn't know anything about the cultural studies, and so they the Zionist state put them together in this state, and of course the Ashkenazic they feel superior, and also because you know that many whites are supremacists, so they feel like a supremacist race against the other Jews, the other target.
This this sample of the overall population correctly reflects on the overall privilege received by the white European settlers as opposed to the inequalities, disparities, and racism received by Eastern, Spanish, and North African Jews. The left-wing Ashkenazis enjoy wide support from secularly white Europeans, while the right-wing receives support from non-secularist white European Ashkenazis. Both the left and right receive some support from the rest of Israelis, including Mizrahi, Sephardic, North African Jews, and Arabs, who to them are political game and are in demand during voting times, as they represent a large number, and large numbers means more votes. Israeli observers say that this battle proves that the left-wing Zionists in Israel are actually right-wing with a different color. As the subject is a hot topic in Israel, politicians also took part in the discussion. Members of the left-wing Ashkenazi Israelis claim that the river is part of the kibbutz members' home and that entering it amounts to a violent invasion. Yeli Yakubs, a senior Nir David official and board member of the Israeli Women's Network, the Israel's largest leftist national feminist organization, drew a parallel between the protest and sexual assault. One prominent left-wing personality suggested that the Osir River struggle is just not that important, and another jokingly ranked it at number 43 on a list of the 42 critical struggles for the future of Israel. The right-wing, or those loyal to Netanyahu's party who have some support from Mizrahi Jews, argued that allowing free access to the river would destroy it, as public visitors would not keep the river and its banks clean. This is not true at all, as the tourism office of the Nir David Kibbutz actually allows visitors from outside the local area to visit, only if they pay. Activists believe that this argument heavily relies on racist stereotypes regarding the hygiene and cleanliness of the surrounding area's Mizrahi residents.
In general, it's true that the immigrants from North Africa or from Eastern or Sephardic countries have been struggling in the early years, and there were there was a problem with sharing or dividing the natural resources or the financial resources between those different communities. Historically speaking, today things are a little bit different, but still there are pockets of racism and pockets of ill justice between those communities.
The conversation lasted a while on Twitter. Eno says, soon the river of trash and ash. I totally understood why they did not want to open it. They should at least install a system that ensures those who litter can be identified and held accountable. Joshua points out, guards at Nir David near Beit Shean chasing away hikers who want to visit the Asi stream, a public waterway which flows through the kibbutz, but which they zealously guard, unless you pay them protection by staying at a guest house there. This is an ongoing fight. Sharuna says, the Ashkenazim appointed Arabs to guard them from the Mizrahis. Scum. Oz says, common denominator, a minority that controls the majority, streams and routes in the areas of the kibbutzim, natural resources of us all, an elite that controls the top, academia, and other clubs close to the masses. Salute and be silent.
Well, what's true about religion, again, is that, you know, all the Jews were religious everywhere in the world until, let's say, the 19th century, the later part of the 18th century. And then in the later part of the 18th century into the 19th century, you had in Europe the Enlightenment. And the Enlightenment was really a movement away from religion, towards science, towards secularism. And you had in the Jewish community Jews leaving the religious world and becoming secular. Some became communists, like Trotsky. Some became socialists, like Ben-Gurion and many of those that founded the State of Israel. Well, you never had the Enlightenment in the Middle East, which is on today a problem. So the Middle East never had a concept of secular. And so Jews, Mizrahi Jews, weren't as orthodox. They weren't as strict as the Ashkenazi Jews had been when they were religious. And they mix much more what we'd call today secular and religious. They're much lighter in their religion, but they're religious. Or we would call them, I guess, traditional might be the best word to call them. They're not super orthodox, but on the other hand, they're not secular either. And I think this is a whole issue in the Muslim world. The entire Muslim world, I think, is wrestling today with this idea, with this problem of enlightenment and secularism and religion. It's a tension. And so it's also a tension between Ashkenazi Jews and Mizrahi Jews.
Nir David neighborhood has over the past few months highlighted the struggles in what is seen as a small sample representing the greater fight between Ashkenazi Jews and the other marginalized communities. Nir David is predominantly made up of Ashkenazim, Jews of European descent who founded Israel and dominated its resources, as well as its economic, cultural, and military institutions. These neighborhoods house Ashkenazi Jews both in the right and the left. The residents of Nir David do not allow access to the Asi River, and if they do, it will not be free. They have erected fences and barriers to prevent public access to the river. According to the Israeli regime's Water Act, waterways are public property that must remain accessible and open to all. Despite this, the status quo remains the same. In order to change the small sample presented here, the bigger picture needs to come down.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The 13th presidential election. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Iran's 13th presidential election is going to be held on June 18th. In this episode of this series, we are going to discuss elections in India and Pakistan and compare them with Iran. Stay tuned, please. is home to over 1 billion and 300 million people. President is elected indirectly in India. In other words, people do not participate in the election. The representatives of three legislative houses, namely People's Lower House, Lok Sabha, Upper House, Rajya Sabha, and States House, vote on behalf of their advocates. The result of presidential election will be determined on a special calculation. The vote of each member of the central or state legislature has a separate value. And the candidate who gains the highest votes will take power. According to Article 79 of the Indian Constitution, the parliament consists of the president, the People's House, and Upper House. The president will be elected by parties of partisan coalition via the Electoral College. The president can be elected 2 terms. Each term takes 5 years. Any problem on the presidential election will be heard and resolved through the Supreme Court of India. The president is not the executive official, and this authority is undertaken by the Prime Minister. Although the president is ceremonial in India, he or she enjoys wide legal authorities according to the Constitution. He or she is considered as the head of the legislature, executive and judiciary, and also the commander-in-chief of the armed forces in the country. The Constitution has made it clear that the president can wield his or her legal authorities indirectly, except very limited issues. However, it is the Prime Minister who uses all the executive authorities of the President through the Ministerial Council. The president in India should be at least 35 years old, but there is no maximum limit for it. According to Article 61 of the Constitution, if he or she does any action contrary to the Constitution, he or she will be dismissed. His dismissal should get the votes of 1/4 of the MPs, who will do it 4 days after the proposal for dismissal. Many regional and neighboring countries enjoy similarities with Iran in terms of ethnicities, religions, and cultures. India, for instance, enjoys different creeds like Islam, Christianity, Hinduism, and Buddhism. Thus, cultural and religious variety is very important in the country. 85% of the population in India is Hindu and 13.5% is Muslim. Yet India has the highest Muslim population after Indonesia and Pakistan. In Iran, too, there are various ethnicities such as Turk, Lor, Kurd, Baluch, Arab, Turkmen, and so on. There are Christians, Jews, Zoroastrians, and others, too, who live peacefully with Muslims. Muslims shape over 99% of the population. Muslims consist of Shias and Sunnis who live brotherly with each other. According to the Constitution, every 150,000 people should have a member in the parliament, but the religious minorities enjoy at least one representative in the parliament, although some of them are below 50,000 in the country. Political analyst and university professor Mohammad Reza Marandi says on restrictions and discriminations for some minorities in India, according to the official statistics, 150 million Muslim citizens live in India who constitute 14% of the population. But during elections, the Muslim community has always been concerned over inattention to their demands by parties and candidates. This comes while Muslims build up an important part of large states like Uttar Pradesh. The election system in Pakistan is like India. In other words, it has been highly affected by the patterns of the British colonial rule and occupation. The people in cities choose their representatives in the form of city councils, and the people in villages choose theirs in the form of village councils. These representatives then are authorized to vote for the members of parliament, and in the end, these MPs will choose the president without the people's involvement. This system has changed since 1935 Constitution of India and Pakistan in a way that there are voting circles and the criteria for representatives and election are wealth, properties, and graduation level. Voting specifically belongs to the people whose names are registered in the list of participants in elections, so no one out of the list is entitled to vote.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on March 21st, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Nowruz.
Things have changed to the advantage of Iran. We do not consider American promises to be valid. If they say that they will lift them on paper, this is of no use. What is necessary is action. They should lift the sanctions in practice. Subsequently, we will verify their statements to make sure that the sanctions have been lifted. Then we will resume our commitments. Surprisingly, some Americans have issues with the nuclear deal. I have heard some Americans say that this year's circumstances are different from the solar years of 1394 and 1395. When the Barjam was signed, and that therefore the deal should change as well. I too agree that things have changed compared to the solar years of 1394 and 1395, but not to the advantage of the US. They have changed to our advantage. Things have changed to the advantage of Iran, not to your advantage. Iran has become much stronger compared to 1394. It has managed to rely on itself and it has found self-confidence. However, you have become disreputable in this period of time. During this time, an administration held office in the US which made your country disreputable with its statements, actions, and behavior. Economic problems have engulfed your entire country, so things are not to your advantage. Yes, circumstances have changed, but to your disadvantage. If the Barjam is supposed to change, it should change in a way that Iran will profit from it, not the Americans. We thankfully rendered the sanctions ineffectual with the help of many knowledge-based companies. The youth's great movement and various innovations in this regard, and by Allah's favor, we will continue this path. But you, on the other hand, have faced more problems every day. It is not even clear either what the fate of this president will be. I want to add that we are in no hurry at all about what we offered as a solution. Some people say that there is an opportunity and that one should not let opportunities slip our grasp. I too believe that opportunities should be seized on time and they should not be missed. But we should not hurry either. Being in a hurry sometimes leads to more harm than wasting opportunities. An example is on the issue of the Barjam. We should not have hurried. All their promises existed only on paper, but ours materialized on the ground. We fulfilled our obligations in a hasty manner, but they did not fulfill their obligations. It is a very important issue to know that we have abundant patience and that we are doing our job. If they accept and then act on the policy that we announced, then everything will be all right. But if they do not do it, things will remain the way they are now, and that will be fine.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
There is clearly a global pattern that connects UNHCR involvement to unrest in refugee camps. The question is, why has this pattern been ignored for more than a decade? In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Gionet Bernier, writer. This article is published under the heading, Refugees Insist Humanitarian Organization UNHCR disregards their humanity. Stay tuned for more. Since late 2019, waves of protest against the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, the supranational branch of United Nations that works to help displaced populations globally, have rocked a refugee camp in Lebanon that holds over 2,000 Sudanese and Ethiopian inhabitants. For months, refugee protesters have stood behind the gates of the camp in front of flimsy, poorly insulated tents and held sit-ins in front of a UNHCR building. Their signs read, "Where are my rights?" And they proclaim the UNHCR does not respect their humanity. In December 2019, these protests became so disruptive, at one point even devolving into riots, that the UNHCR called its own staff and security forces to arrest and detain many of the protesters. One of the organizers of the protest, a 30-year-old Sudanese refugee named Abdul Baghi, acknowledged that many of the refugee protesters were frustrated by systematic issues with the UNHCR, such as inadequate provision of basic services and a convoluted resettlement process. However, he noted that those grievances are not the primary motivation behind the protest. Instead, these refugees resent that there are abuses that have happened on the part of the UNHCR, a general sense of neglect and disrespect for the refugees as human beings, with no training of their staff, on top of them saying that they have no funds. Specifically, many protesters are claiming they had been verbally threatened or harassed by the UNHCR staff. Unrest has long been a defining feature of refugee camps. Overcrowding, tensions between displaced groups of different national origins, and a lack of resources, issues that are understandably endemic to the resettlement and asylum process given the scale of the global refugee crisis, are oft-cited explanations for camp protests. However, refugees fleeing as though the UNHCR has not treated them as human beings, worthy of equal dignity, may be an overlooked catalyst of this unrest. It is helpful to think of this issue through historian and director of the World Peace Foundation, Alex D. Wall's framework of inescapable and escapable cruelties. On one hand, inescapable cruelty for humanitarian organizations comes in the contrast between the overwhelming global need and organizations' resource constraints. The cruelty of choosing between equally vulnerable people and populations, especially for limited resettlement opportunities, is inherent to and inescapable from humanitarian work. Escapable cruelty, on the other hand, refers to failing of humanitarian organizations that are entirely avoidable. The UNHCR's explanation for the unrest in Lebanon uses the typical excuse of inescapable cruelties for violence in refugee camps to dodge the issue of potential dehumanization and escapable cruelty. In response to the protesters, the UNHCR head of field in Beirut, Laura Almiral, made this statement: "We consider everyone, but it doesn't mean that everyone can or will get the services, from cash assistance, healthcare, to access to education. We are working with limited funding and resources." While this response might explain the neglect of which these refugees have accused the UNHCR, it does not explain the allegations that the UNHCR, a humanitarian organization, has unnecessarily disrespected these refugees' humanity. The Lebanon protests suggest that there are two different conversations occurring around human rights in refugee camps. The UNHCR's narrative has emerged in Almiral's response in a statement on the institution's official Facebook page, where it characterized the allegations of disrespect as inaccurate and misleading, stating that UNHCR staff have at no time used verbal or physical abuse against the protesters, leaving the protesters largely ignored. Is there any truth to the UNHCR's denial? It would seem that history is not on the side. In a 2010 survey of various African origin refugees living in Egyptian camps, nearly a quarter of respondents reported that their interactions with the staff from UNHCR, Cairo, were their worst life experiences since the war-related atrocities they fled. Furthermore, 90.9% of respondents felt quite a bit or extremely betrayed by the UNHCR after its official called Egyptian security forces to disperse informal refugee settlements in Egypt, with no attempts made to engage in conversation or negotiate with the refugees. The confrontation between the refugees and security forces resulted in 23 deaths, hundreds of arrests, and thousands of injuries. All study participants reported feelings of frequent hate, resentment, and disgust towards the UNHCR as a result of the betrayal. The Egyptian case represented overt dismissals of refugee concerns, but the UNHCR's dehumanization of refugees can also be more subtle and systematic. Take, for example, a group of Burundian refugees attempt to violently take public authority in a Tanzanian refugee camp away from the UNHCR camp officials and establish self-governance. There is clearly a global pattern that connects UNHCR involvement to unrest in refugee camps. The question is, why has this pattern been ignored for more than a decade? With few or no media outlets available to them, refugees' grievances have been drowned out by the UNHCR-perpetuated narrative, especially when that narrative is amplified and endorsed by the international press. Events like protracted riots in Moura refugee camp on the island of Lesbos, Greece, have driven mainstream media reporting on this trend of refugee resentment towards the UNHCR. However, major news outlets such as CNN and Al Jazeera have chalked up the asylum seekers' grievances to systematic problems such as overcrowding, lack of appropriate settlers, and insufficient food. Some sources have been attributed the most recent unrest in Moura as misplaced anger stemming from their frustration that the pandemic has brought resettlement to standstill. In doing so, these sources have perpetuated the UNHCR's narrative that any cruelties they have committed are inescapable. Millions of asylum seekers around the world live in similarly poor conditions in camps and informal settlements. But not all camps are plagued by riots, and not all camps' dwellers express virulent anger towards the camp governors in the way the refugees in Lebanon, Egypt, and Tanzania have towards the UNHCR. Clearly, the refugees in case studies mentioned were not mobilized by poor quality of life, but because people who represent the UNHCR have added unnecessary insult to their inevitable injury. Despite the UNHCR's attempts to downplay or discredit these complaints, where there is smoke, there is fire. Feeling dehumanized by the UNHCR is a complaint that spans across different nationalities, countries, and continents. In fact, this feeling has even united refugees of different ethnic groups and national origins, identifiers that usually divide camp dwellers.